Hello Buddhas and welcome back. We are starting chapter 4 of volume 1, Light of Compassion. And I feel that we all need some of that in our lives. In fact, the world can surely do with more of that, really, at this time. Anyways, we will read from pages 221 to 241. So here we go. Light of Compassion. The compassionate light of Buddhism was now about to illuminate the skyscrapers of the United States' largest city, New York. Shinichi Yamamoto's flight from Toronto arrived shortly after 2 p.m. at New York's Idlewild, now JFK, International Airport. He and the other leaders were about 2.5 hours behind schedule. Despite this delay, more than 10 Soka Gakkai members were on hand to greet them with an energetic rendition of the song Ifu Dodo no Uta, the song of indomitable dignity. Amid the members' welcoming applause, a young girl of about 4 or 5 presented Shinichi with a bouquet of flowers. True to the global economic center that it was, the city of New York overflowed with energy and activity. Shinichi gazed in awe at the forest of skyscrapers, with the Empire State Building standing tallest among them. The party was staying at a Manhattan hotel at Broadway and 34th Street. The hum of endlessly flowing traffic could be heard even in Shinichi's room on the 19th floor. When he closed his eyes, it sounded like the roar of the ocean or the cheering of a great crowd. He pictured in his mind the samurai of the first Japanese delegation to the United States, which had paraded down Broadway 100 years earlier. On May 22, 1860, they exchanged ratification papers for the U.S.-Japan Treaty of Amity and Commerce in Washington. Later, the delegation had visited New York, where they received a grand welcome from its citizens. The delegation went down Broadway in carriages, surrounded by an honor guard, 7,000 strong. Tens of thousands packed sidewalks, their cheering echoing in the skies. A witness to this parade, the poet Walt Whitman, praised it in verse at the meeting of a youthful and free America and the ancient, all-embracing motherland of Asia. Over the western sea hither from Nippon come, courteous, the swart-cheeked, two-sworded envoys, leaning back in their open barouches, bareheaded, impassive. Whitman had cherished a vision that this encounter with the East would supply America with something it lacked, thereby making it whole and complete. Now, 100 years later, Shinichi took his first step on Broadway as an emissary of the Eastern philosophy of Buddhism. In stark contrast to the enthusiastic throngs that had greeted that first mission of envoys a century earlier, Shinichi and his party were met by only a handful of members. Shinichi, however, was determined to make his visit the dawn of true interaction between America and the all-encompassing philosophy of the East, the fusion of which Walt Whitman had so yearned for. The next morning, October 14, the group visited the UN headquarters. The 15th UN General Assembly, which had begun on September 20th, was in regular session. It was attended by 10 heads of state, 13 prime ministers, and 57 foreign ministers, including the leaders of the Eastern and Western blocs, Prime Minister Nikita S. Khrushchev of the Soviet Union, and President Dwight D. Eisenhower of the United States. With the conspicuous attendance of the world's leaders, this session of the General Assembly took on the air of a summit, matching the UN's purpose to serve as a parliament of humankind. During the session, 17 nations, including Cameroon, Togo, and Madagascar, were admitted as members. With the exception of Cyprus, all these countries were newly independent African states. This brought the UN membership to 99 nations, of which 45 belonged to the Asia-Africa bloc. This represented a major redrawing of the political map of the world, since it gave the members of the Asia-Africa bloc a greater influence in the deliberations of the General Assembly. This session, though it saw the increase of UN membership and the attendance of many of the world's leaders, was a stormy one, marked by a renewed deepening of the schism between Eastern and Western blocs. The tense mood in the General Assembly was particularly pronounced following the speech that Khrushchev had delivered on September 23rd, the second day of the general debate. After welcoming the newly admitted African states to the United Nations, Khrushchev launched on a pointed attack of the United States. Citing the spy flights by American U-2 reconnaissance aircraft over Soviet territory earlier that year, he slammed the United States for obstructing and easing in international tensions. In addition, he called for the immediate and complete dismantling of colonialism. The Soviet premier also turned his attack on UN Secretary General Dan Hammarskjöld, saying that all Secretary General of the world body to date had been selected from among Western-leaning candidates. He proposed a plan for restructuring the United Nations, in which the position of Secretary General would be abolished and replaced with an executive council of three, one from the Western powers, one from the socialist bloc, and one from the non-aligned countries. These hardline proposals came amid an atmosphere of deepening mistrust between the East and West. For the Western countries, none of the elements of these proposals was in any way acceptable. Rather, they appeared to be a deliberate provocation. In particular, the idea of eliminating the position of Secretary General was viewed in the West as a direct challenge to the United Nations. Unlike the previous year's General Assembly, when a mood of détente had prevailed, this year's session was marked by an atmosphere of turbulence and discord. When Dag Hammarskjöld indicated that he had no intention of acceding to the demand that he resign as Secretary General, Khrushchev expressed his dissatisfaction by loudly pounding on the table in front of him. From the start of the session, opinion was divided as to whether disarmament issues should be taken up in committee or in plenary session. When the Soviet Union insisted that it had to be treated as a plenary topic, the Western countries objected, saying that the Soviet request was for propaganda purposes only. Standing at the speaker's podium and waving both arms, Soviet Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev embarked on a verbal counterattack, saying that it was a question of whether disarmament was to be pursued in earnest. If the West wanted an arms race, he said, then that was fine with the Soviet Union. Soviet rockets were capable of reaching any place on Earth or even outer space. He hinted of dire consequences should the present situation continue. The American and French representatives fiercely rebutted the Soviet leader's statement. When, on the subject of colonialism, the American representative stated that there were many countries in Eastern Europe without freedom, the representatives of the Eastern Bloc began pounding on their table en masse. The representative from Romania ran up to the chairman's seat, adding to the uproar. Outraged, the chairman pounded his gavel and declared a recess. In his fury, he struck the gavel with such force that it broke. People the world over long for peace. This simple desire, however, was never given true voice by the representatives of the member states attending the General Assembly. The shouted cries of the mouthpieces of rival ideologies, estranged from human reality, resounded meaninglessly in the assembly hall. For the United Nations to truly function as a parliament of humankind, it is vital that the representatives of each nation, through a spirit of friendship and dialogue, remember that they are all members of the same human family. Shinichi and his party visited the UN headquarters the day after Khrushchev, who had been at the United Nations for 25 days, left for the Soviet Union. The group observed both committee and plenary proceedings. They were particularly impressed by the vibrant expressions worn by the representatives of the newly independent African states. These countries, which had been subject to colonial rule, were faced with many difficult problems in such fields as politics, economics, education and human rights. Many of these leaders, however, were youthful, proud, and brimming with fresh energy. They were free of the arrogance and craftiness so often seen in the aged leaders of great powers. Shinichi was filled with hope for the future of Africa. He saw there the beginnings of a new current of history. Turning to Aisuke Akizuki, he said, "The 21st century will surely be the century of Africa. The world should support the growth of this young sapling in every respect." His eyes were fixed on the distant future. After visiting the UN headquarters, the party travelled to New Jersey, where a discussion meeting was to be held. The meeting place was the home of Yukiko Nishino, the elder sister of Nagayasu Masaki. Yukiko had moved to New Jersey from Washington, D.C. Just outside the house, Shinichi Yamamoto met a woman and a young man, both of them Japanese. He greeted them politely and handed them his name card. The young man, who introduced himself as Mitsuo Sugihara, was an employee of a Japanese trading company and had been stationed in the United States. He had brought the woman, the wife of an adjunct university professor, to the meeting at Nishino's request. The woman was a Soka Gakkai member, but Sugihara was not. It was thus clear that the local members had asked even their non-member friends to lend their cooperation to ensuring the success of the discussion meeting. The meeting was scheduled to start at 6:30 p.m. and the time until then was put to use making plans for the establishment of a district. The discussion meeting began, attended by more than 10 people, including guests. Most of the participants were Japanese women, almost all of whose husbands had been stationed in Japan with the US military. Fatigue from the strain of daily living was clearly visible on the members' faces. Shinichi spoke to each of the participants, asking about their home lives. The first woman he addressed responded in a small and forlorn voice. "My husband is in the military and is stationed overseas. My child and I are waiting for his return." "Is that so? You must miss him very much. When your husband returns, please show him how much you care for him. Until then, although it will be very difficult for you all alone, please do your best to raise your child to be a fine young person. Nothing will make your husband happier than knowing that your child is growing up healthy and strong. This is the greatest possible encouragement for him. If your husband knows that you are cheerful and in high spirits, he will feel reassured and can display his full capabilities at work. On the other hand, if your husband thinks that you are lonely and depressed, he will be concerned and unable to devote himself wholeheartedly to his work. Therefore, please be cheerful and vibrant. Please become strong enough so that you can write and tell him that you are fine and that he, for his part, should also do his best. Unless you yourself are strong, you cannot be kind and considerate of others." A slight trace of color had returned to the woman's earnest face. Shinichi Yamamoto then addressed the next woman, who was around 30. Her hair was disheveled and she wore an air of careless resignation, as if her heart had grown desolate from living without hope. "What kind of work does your husband do?" asked Shinichi. "He hardly does any at all," the woman responded. "When he was stationed in Japan with the military, he told me tales about how I'd have a maid and a wonderful life when I returned to America with him. But my life here has been awful. He drinks all the time, never works, and becomes violent. It's horrible. Basically, I was fooled. I guess you could say it's my fault for believing him in the first place. But I've had just about all I can take." As she spoke, several of the other women nodded in sympathy. At every discussion meeting Shinichi and the others attended in the United States, there were members who had expressed discontent with their circumstances, but it was clear that these women of New York were suffering more than most. Her face flushed with agitation, Katsu Kiyohara, the Soka Gakkai Women's Division Chief, addressed the woman pointedly. "But you're doing gongyo, aren't you? You're praying to the Gohonzon, aren't you?"
"No."
"What do you mean, no? When you joined, you were told the importance of doing gongyo and chanting Daimoku every day, weren't you?"
"I was never told any such thing. When I was leaving for America, my mother said, 'You're going to a country that was Japan's enemy in the war. Who knows what could happen to you? You'd better receive the Gohonzon and pray to it if you have a problem.'"
It seemed that there had been virtually no guidance in faith in New York up to that point. Until the arrival of Yukiko Nishino, there had been no one to act as a central figure around whom the members could gather, no one to encourage them and give them direction. Kiyohara began speaking with great force. "Well, leaving aside how you came to this point, the only way for you to accumulate good fortune is to do your best for American Kosen Rufu."
"Kosen what?"
Kiyohara was at a loss for words. "This is serious," she thought. "I'll have to teach them the very basics of faith equaling daily life." Out loud, she said, You don't know what that is? It means teaching people throughout this land about the Daishonin's Buddhism and enabling them to become happy. This is the mission you all have." Even as she said this, Kiyohara found herself wondering how to guide these members. Katsu Kiyohara took a deep breath and began to speak with renewed determination. "It looks like you've never had the opportunity to learn the basics of this faith. That can't be helped. Now, please listen carefully. The Buddhist practice consists of practice for oneself and practice for others. Practice for ourselves means doing gongyo and chanting Daimoku, while practice for others means teaching people about this Buddhism. The Daishonin has promised us that when we practice faith correctly in this way, we can achieve a state of supreme happiness. If you do so, not only can your husbands find jobs, but you yourselves can realize a truly regal state of life where you can travel to Japan anytime you wish."
"That's unbelievable. Impossible."
The room was filled with the sound of members voicing their disbelief. A young woman who had been silent until then suddenly cried out, "You say we can visit Japan whenever we want someday, but I can't wait that long. Please take me back with you. I can't stand it anymore." She burst into tears. The leaders accompanying Shinichi stared at the woman with stunned expressions. Shinichi's eyes, however, were bright and penetrating. He was now pushing the limits of physical exhaustion, and the leaders accompanying him were well aware of this. Removing his jacket, Shinichi began speaking in a quiet yet powerful tone. "You have all truly suffered. You have endured in silence. There must have been times when you felt like giving up. There must have been times when you felt that death would bring a welcome release. I can deeply appreciate how much pain and sadness you must feel. However, this Buddhism has the power to transform your suffering into happiness, to change the tears you have shed into glittering jewels of good fortune. Those who have wept the most bitterly have the right to become the happiest people of all. My purpose in coming to the United States is to help you turn that into a reality." Shinichi burned with a determination to shine the compassionate light of Buddhism into the darkness of suffering in people's lives. Passion and energy issued forth from his entire being, and his powerful words deeply shook the lives of all in attendance. The atmosphere of the meeting was now completely different. Driven by an earnest determination to encourage the members, Shinichi continued, "I'm sure you're all wondering whether you can really become happy through this practice. Am I right?" The women all nodded in agreement. He continued with powerful conviction, "There's nothing to worry about. So long as you persevere in your practice, each of you, without exception, can become happy. In Japan, there are actually more than 1 million of our fellow members who have become happy.
Isn't that the greatest possible proof? The Buddhist scriptures contain the following parable. There was once a man who visited the home of a close friend. He was entertained until he became quite drunk and fell asleep. While he was sleeping, his friend took a jewel of the highest imaginable value and sewed it into the lining of the guest's robe, hoping to protect him from a life of want or worry. The participants in the meeting listened attentively, thoroughly absorbed by what Shinichi was saying. The guest then set off for other parts. He fell on hard times and became so desperately poor that he was often forced to go hungry. Throughout this time, he remained completely unaware of the priceless jewel sewn inside his robe. It was in this state of extreme poverty that the man again encountered his friend. The friend informed him of the precious jewel affixed to his garment. Naturally, once the man learned of the jewel's existence, he could become happy. This is the parable of the priceless jewel from the Lotus Sutra. The precious jewel is an allegory for the life of the Buddha, the state of ultimate happiness which exists in the hearts of each of you. This life condition can be brought forth and manifested by praying to the Gohonzon and fighting for Kosenrufu. If, despite having taken faith in this Buddhism, you fail to understand this and remain submerged in sadness, you are just like the man in the parable. The eyes of the participants were shining. Smiling, Shinichi continued. A few moments ago, Miss Kiyohara said that you could attain a regal state of life. Nichiren Daishonin has declared unequivocally that we are all children of the Buddha. From the perspective of Buddhism, it is clear that each of you is a human treasure, possessing supreme good fortune and the highest mission. Your status surpasses even that of kings and queens. In light of this, there is no way you will remain mired in unhappiness. Shinichi then introduced each of the leaders accompanying him, asking them to share their experiences and to explain why benefit can be realized through the practice of faith. In sharp contrast to the situation of a few moments earlier, the expressions of the participants were now filled with the energy of an awakened seeking spirit. When the leaders from Japan had finished speaking, Shinichi asked, "Now do you understand why this practice is important?" With bright faces, the participants nodded in affirmation. With an embracing smile, Shinichi continued speaking. "All of you are still young, your husbands are in good health, and your children are small. It is not unusual, however, for women to outlive their husbands and to be left to fend for themselves. That is the critical time in a woman's life. This Buddhism enables you to create a palace within your heart, to establish a condition of absolute happiness that cannot be destroyed under any circumstances. That is why it is vital to practice faith throughout your entire life." Shinichi then announced the formation of the New York district, after which he handed the participants the fukusa he had brought as gifts. At this point, one woman who had come to the meeting as a guest expressed her decision to start practicing. While listening to Shinichi speak, she had begun to embrace the hope that she too could become happy. And she had decided that she very much wanted to take faith in the Daishonin's Buddhism. The room reverberated with congratulatory applause. Another guest, Mitsuo Sugihara, the young trading company employee Shinichi had met earlier, had also been paying close attention to the proceedings. He had already heard about this Buddhism from Nagayasu Masaki and Susumu Aota on many occasions, but had been critical of the Soka Gakkai. At the time, he was facing a personal crisis at work, having been forced to take responsibility for a management blunder. Nevertheless, he had steadfastly refused to join the Soka Gakkai because he felt that to do so would be an admission of defeat to Masaki and Aota. At first, he had watched the proceedings as an observer, curious to see how Shinichi would respond to the women's outbursts of discontent. But he gradually felt himself being moved by the force of Shinichi's guidance, by the sincerity and passion with which he strove to encourage the members. Sugihara thought, "This person is working desperately for the happiness of complete strangers. I never thought there could be a world of such warmth." Having experienced the coldness and indifference of people in society, Sugihara was astounded by what he was witnessing. 1 month later, Sugihara began practicing. He became the first young men's division member in New York. At the discussion meeting, Shinichi had not made any explicit attempt to urge Sugihara to take faith. He had simply given his all to communicating the way to realize a life of victory and human glory. This was done out of his deep desire for the happiness of his fellow members who had gathered at the meeting. As in Aesop's fable, The Sun and the Wind, it is not the bitter chill of the north wind that causes people to remove the cloaks from their hearts. Rather, this is only achieved by the warm, compassionate light of the sun, caring and all-embracing. For it is such warmth that gives rise to the melodies of true human empathy. Since arriving in New York, Shinichi's condition had taken a turn for the worse. Chills constantly racked his feverish body, and his legs were shaky when he walked. The punishing schedule of the group's overseas trip was taking an incredible toll on Shinichi's already frail health. Not wanting his companions to worry about him, Shinichi took pains to conceal his discomfort and distress. No meetings were scheduled the next day, October 15th, so the group could prepare for their trip to Brazil. Shinichi stayed at the hotel to rest while the other leaders went shopping and sightseeing around the city. That evening, however, he was scheduled to attend a dinner with representatives from various Japanese trading companies in New York who had assisted in the purchase of construction materials for the grand reception hall. On October 16, Shinichi and his party traveled by train to the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., a trip that took a little more than 4 hours. Shinichi found it restful to gaze quietly out at the deepening fall landscape reminiscent of the woodlands of Tokyo's Musashino area. It was around 1 p.m. when the train pulled in at D.C.'s Union Station. About 20 people, lined up neatly in 4 rows, welcomed the party with a gakkai song. Some Japanese women in the front row held a large banner emblazoned with the words Soka Gakkai in Japanese. As soon as the members caught sight of Shinichi, their eyes grew moist and their singing faltered. Standing to one side of the chorus was a middle-aged American man who wore an armband on which someone had inadvertently written the Japanese word Unsohan, freight group, instead of Yusohan, transport group. Also, attached to the antenna of one of the cars waiting for them outside was a triangular pennant which proclaimed in English Soka Gakkai, the word Gakkai having been misspelled. Shinichi was nevertheless moved by the members' sincerity, which he treasured above all else. "Thank you for your welcome. I am deeply touched." Because they were in the middle of the station, Shinichi kept his words brief, but he did not neglect to express his heartfelt appreciation for the members' earnest efforts. The car, driven by the American man in charge of transportation, bore Shinichi towards the house of Fumie Shearing, where a discussion meeting was to be held. When Shinichi took his seat in the car, the man greeted him with a friendly smile and a cheerful Konnichiwa, good afternoon. Washington was a tranquil city set amid abundant greenery, with none of the towering rows of skyscrapers or the noise and bustle of a great metropolis like New York. The Shearings' house was located in a quiet residential area and fronted by a well-tended lawn. Fumi Shearing, who was acting as the central figure for the members in Washington, D.C., was standing at the entrance to greet Shinichi and his party. Her arm was bandaged, and she wore sunglasses and a scarf around her head. What happened? Shinichi asked in concern. Excuse me for looking like this, she began, and then went on to explain somewhat hesitantly what had happened. Her gas oven had exploded when she tried to light it earlier that day, the result, apparently, of an undetected gas leak. She had sustained burns on her face and arm. Are you all right? Asked Shinichi anxiously. Yes, the doctor said the burns are minor. Well, I'm glad to hear that, said Shinichi, relieved. He continued, Buddhism teaches the principle of lessening karmic retribution. Through the benefit of faith, we can transform heavy, negative karma accumulated from our past lives and receive its effects in a much lighter form in this lifetime. Your accident today may be an example of this principle. For all you know, you may have been saved from a much bigger tragedy. It is important that you dedicate yourself to your practice with this conviction and with a corresponding sense of gratitude. This will open a path towards good fortune and courage. At the same time, however, please make a determination not to have any more accidents and pay key attention to preventing them. If we think we will be protected just because we chant and allow ourselves to grow careless, we cannot be said to be practicing faith correctly. Rather, because we are practicing faith, we must stay alert at all times, doing everything we can to avoid accidents. This is true faith. When we practice this way, the power of our daimoku will come alive as wisdom and good fortune. Shinichi wanted to refute the kind of faith that placed hope for salvation in an external power, a trap that the members could easily fall into. The discussion meeting began at 2 p.m. The first question came from a Japanese woman whose husband was a non-member. My husband is very supportive of my practice, but he rejects the idea of becoming a member himself because he is Catholic. I can't help feeling that as long as he refuses to take faith, it will be impossible for me to become happy. What can I do to make him start practicing? This was a common dilemma shared not only by the Washington DC members, but also by those in other parts of the United States. This woman's husband was the man who, as a member of the freight group, had driven Shinichi to the meeting. Hearing this, Shinichi replied with a smile. You have a husband who is making sincere efforts for Kosen Ryufu. He displayed the Soka Gakkai flag and happily provided us with transportation. That's wonderful. There's no need to worry about whether he is a member. Such formalities are not important. Some of you may have husbands or other family members who are opposed to your practice. However, it is foolish to become emotional and embroiled in arguments with them over faith. Should your husband become deadlocked or make a serious mistake at work, I would ask you particularly to refrain from telling him it's because you don't practice faith. It may be lonely being the only person practicing in your family, but if you exert yourself diligently, your benefit and good fortune will extend to and be shared by your entire family. Your presence will be just like a huge umbrella sheltering them from the rain. It is a mistake, therefore, to think that you and your family cannot become happy because no one but you practices. Offering prayers for your family members to take faith in the Daishonin's Buddhism so they may become happy is certainly important. But the most fundamental thing is for each of you to demonstrate the greatness of faith with your own life. If you continue to strive in faith as wives and mothers, growing as human beings and becoming sunny presences overflowing with good cheer, wisdom, warmth and consideration, then your families will naturally come to approve of this Buddhism. Thus, to be loved and deeply respected by your families is the first step to winning them over to this practice. Shinichi tried to drive home the fact that Buddhism is the height of good sense and reason. Let's stop there for today. We recently discussed in our group how each of us can be Shinichi Yamamoto. So before I end this recording, I would like to ask you, my listeners, to think how you can be Shinichi Yamamoto. When reading The New Human Revolution, what is it that inspires you? And what is it that you want to bring into your own life? So with those questions, and I hope that they drive some good thoughts and bring some positivity into your life and helps you overcome your challenges, I will leave you today. Have a lovely day.